Hi, I'm Mark Franklin, and you're listening to Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations. Today on your show, building cool things and disrupting entrenched systems. Hi, I'm Mark Franklin, practice leader of a team of professional career counselors at CareerCycles.com. I'm pleased to be your host today on Career Buzz, and thanks for tuning in this morning. When you get a theoretical master's degree in systems design engineering, do you go on to do a PhD and have an academic career, or do you cut loose from academe and get your hands dirty while trying to make the world a better place? Jonathan Fishbane chose the latter, joined Engineers Without Borders for a couple of years before founding a successful startup called Ethical Ocean that he just sold last year. Stay tuned to hear the before and after of Jonathan Fishbane's career story, leading to his present situation of building cool things and disrupting entrenched systems. But first, how can Canadian companies respond to recent changes in the temporary foreign worker program with creative ways to connect unemployed Canadians to available jobs? Benjamin Guth, an entrepreneur and founder of Mobilize Jobs, is an advocate for Canadian youth from coast to coast. In the ever-changing labor landscape, Benjamin has found new creative ways to attract millennials to industry suffering from employee shortages nationwide. As program manager of both Mobilize Jobs and vice president of recruitment company Diamond Global, Benjamin Guth spearheads strategy and manages the development of these two companies. He's also a member of the Immigration Consultants of Canada Regulatory Council. Benjamin Guth joins me live in studio. Welcome, Benjamin, to Career Buzz.
Thanks so much, Mark. I'm happy to be here.
What do you like about your career these days?
Wow, that is a big question. I would have to say that the amount of fun that I get to have every single day is unsurpassed by anything I've ever done before. I work with an incredible team that allows me to really just change the experiences for so many Canadian youth who are sitting at home right now, living in their parents' basement, unable to find work in their hometown, and I get to send them on adventures. That's probably the most fun I've ever had in my life.
Well, we'll get to those adventures in a few minutes, and it's a really interesting program. What do all the things that you get up to in a typical week, say, both with Mobilize Jobs and with this Diamond recruitment company, what kinds of things do you do?
So most of the time these days I'm traveling across Canada, meeting with employers that are still experiencing a labor shortage, even with the recent economic changes in Western Canada. There are pockets of employers that just cannot find Canadians to fill roles, so it's up to me to consult with them, meet with local members of government and different councils to try to create systems to fill staffing shortages and changes that exist today. So most of my time I'm traveling, I'm going to some of Canada's most interesting places, I'm meeting with some really incredible people, and just I have an incredible team back home to help support the whole process.
What would you say, to be successful in your job now, doing all the things you're doing, what are the top two or three strengths or skills that you draw on?
I think, above all else, the ability to walk into a room and make friends with everybody right away is the most valuable skill I have ever adapted. And I actually got that from my mother. She taught me to really own the room, walk into a room, talk to people, get to know everybody. Networking is the most valuable skill I can honestly say I possess these days.
That's great. I love the way people, I ask that question all the time, and I love the way people use these unique ways to answer the question. My ability to walk into a room and make friends with everyone. That's your skill. Awesome. Let's step back for a couple of minutes and figure out, how did you get here? You did a Bachelor of Commerce once upon a time. What happened when you graduated from that program?
Whoa, I feel almost sacrilegious sharing this from the University of Toronto studio, but I will share that my experience in school probably faded out in third year. Now, I did graduate, I worked all the way through, and I studied, but I lost interest at the end of third year, and I feel today's students, I believe the ratio is 3 in 4 Canadians go to some form of post-secondary education immediately after school. In 1990, that number was actually only around 49%. And the truth was, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know where I wanted to go or what I wanted to study or what I wanted to focus on. So by the end of second year, I actually started my own business out at school at Dalhousie University, and I had a great time in Halifax.
What was that business?
I created a business called the Halifax Adventure Company, which took Canadian university students and we went on surf trips and we went on snowboarding trips and we just took fun, really interesting day trips across the province of Nova Scotia.
Cool. I know there's a few companies now that do those kind of educational tours.
You know, this was as far from educational as possible.
Well, let's say educational in the sense that they're drawing on students, but they're not educational. They're pure fun and R&R.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It was just an interesting way for kids to spend their parents' money and have a lot of fun while doing it. So there are a lot of big universities in Halifax, and the transportation system to get to all of these activities was not well-defined at the time. So we rented a bunch of school buses and we found some local guides and we held some adventure tours. And it was during that process, I mean, I remember taking all of these finance courses, all these stats courses, and that just wasn't my thing. You know, I love business. I love working with people, but there were certain components of a four-year commerce degree that I found I was going to class, I was studying, I would do all right on the exams, then I would forget all the information immediately after walking out of that class.
So what happened with the Halifax Adventure Company? And you did graduate, you started this thing third year. Mm-hmm. Is that what you fell back into at the end of your undergrad?
I passed it off to my brother. He was in Halifax as well at the time, so he managed that company for the time being. It was interesting. I stayed in Halifax for a little time after graduation, and I got a very unfortunate phone call. My mother, who was currently working within the recruitment industry at the time for the Diamond Group of Companies, she was the CEO and founder, she gave me a call telling me that she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And it was a big shock. And at the moment, you know, when family calls, you jump. So she asked if I could come and help her a little bit with the business for the time being while she was going through diagnosis, while she was going through the initial stages of her treatment. And in a couple of weeks, I can return back to Halifax. So I kissed my girlfriend on the cheek. I rented my apartment out to my friend. I left my business to my brother, and I told all my friends I would be back in 3 weeks. And that was the last time I saw any of them. Wow. Well, not my brother. I ended up falling in love with the business. She recovered, thankfully, and she's doing wonderfully
Great.
Now. But that was the foreign recruitment business. And when I had arrived, it was just before the big crash in 2008-2009, she was bringing in candidates all over Canada from about six different countries. And we were having a lot of fun. But the tough thing about working with family is they know your shortcomings and they hold you to a higher standard. And my mother didn't trust me when I first got there.
So you were working with your mother eventually or pretty soon after you landed back in Toronto?
We did a lot of shadowing and we worked together. But this was her business. This was her baby. And she basically told me, you know what? You have to prove yourself if you want to work here and you want to help us. You have to prove that you can do it without screwing up my business. So she bought me a one-way ticket to Whitehorse, Yukon Territories, in January, and said, "Don't come back until you make a sale." She figured I couldn't make any mistakes or damage her brand too much that far on the other side of Canada.
So. And how did it go in Whitehorse?
Well, I learned very quickly that if I didn't move fast, I was going to be frozen solid. So we ended up actually making a couple sales and getting a few new partners out there and seeing the Northern Lights, which was beautiful. And so we came back and we started developing new strategies, bringing on new companies. We quickly became one of the largest providers of temporary foreign workers in Canada.
So your clients would be companies who are hiring temporary foreign workers, is that right?
Absolutely. So we would manage the entire process. We would have client relations teams on site. We would assist employers with the government documentation, with the immigration documentation. We would handle all facets of international recruitment overseas. We were Canada's largest ethical and compliant foreign recruitment agency. So we would actually maintain ownership of the offices across the world, and we would have our own offices to make sure that candidates were not being charged fees, which was a huge problem in the industry years ago. And to ensure that we maintained ownership of that whole piece.
Right on. Mm-hmm. My guest this morning is Benjamin Guth. He's founder of Mobilize Jobs and also vice president of Diamond Global. I'm Mark Franklin, your host here on Career Buzz on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and worldwide at CIUT.fm. So, Benjamin, it's a interesting twist and turn to the story here. You didn't plan on going into the recruitment business, but there you were. And for listeners who are unfamiliar with the recruitment business, what are some of the jobs in there? If people are saying, gee, that's a kind of interesting world of work, what are those different jobs, the people who you are working with, what would those titles or roles be?
Within the recruitment component, we had a lot of different positions within that team. There were operations roles, but the vast majority of positions within HR and recruitment these days are headhunting roles. They're very aggressive sales roles. They're being able to pick up the phone and call somebody who is either happy in their job or not thinking about moving just yet, and convincing them that a better opportunity exists out there for them, and then acting as their representative when speaking to new potential employers that are desperately seeking staff. So it's very much like a real estate agent in that way.
Right. So the skills to succeed in that kind of role?
Negotiation, a lot of networking abilities, very, very valuable in that type of position. The ability to pick up the phone and cold call somebody, you know, is one of the hardest skills I have ever had to learn in my life. And just being very, very thick-skinned.
Yes. Tough for a lot of people. But what are the upsides? What kind of money can people make in that role?
Depending on which element of recruitment individuals are in, the compensation packages can be very, very high. In many cases, I know a lot of people who have gone off and started their own firms. The average fee is around 20% of the first year's salary paid by the employers as an additional cost, which could be $30,000, $40,000 when you start to recruit.
Per recruitment gig, right? When I first learned about that many years ago, I was a little surprised, and maybe listeners are surprised to hear that that's the deal, and that you make one match, and it can be $20,000 or $30,000 right there. So you only need, if you do one a month, count it, you're up to $240,000 a year. So it can be a good upside.
Extremely lucrative if you've got the right team and the right skills in place, but it's hard. There's a lot of people who just cannot take that kind of rejection and who can't convince somebody to move.
So back to your story. You were doing this work, and I was interested to find this connection with the Immigration Consultants of Canada. Mm-hmm. And listeners might not know that that thing even exists. What is that, and who belongs to it?
So the ICCRC, or the Immigration Consultants Regulatory Council of Canada, is the regulating body which regulates the immigration industry in Canada. So basically, if anybody wants to assist another human being with any form of immigration assistance, they can either go to an immigration lawyer or they can come to an immigration consultant. And we would assist the candidates that were interested in coming from overseas with all elements of their work permits and their visas. And hopefully, if they really loved the place they were staying in and the employer supported them, we would assist them with their permanent residency applications as well.
Right. And this is now a regulated field?
You absolutely
have to have this certification to do it, because I guess there's lots of stories of unethical kinds of work in that immigration consulting world.
Absolutely, of ghost consultants. And that's still something that we are always trying to control, but the ICCRC is doing a fantastic job of making sure that everybody who is licensed is practicing in an ethical way.
Right on. So let's fast forward now. I know the Temporary Foreign Worker Program in Canada, there's a big kind of upset around this approximately a year ago, and things changed, and I think that's what led to this Mobilize Jobs thing. So what happened there? What was the genesis of Mobilize Jobs?
So about a year ago, you may remember from the news that there was lots of talk around a moratorium for the Temporary Foreign Worker Program. Basically, the government stood up and said, the numbers of youth unemployment and underemployment are way too high coast to coast, especially in Eastern and Atlantic Canada, that we should not be allowed to bring in international workers to fill labor shortages in Western Canada. And for many employers that were actually using the program, particularly in the hospitality and tourism industries in Whistler or in Banff or in, you know, Fort McMurray, Alberta, it was unheard of to see a 25-year-old from Fredericton, New Brunswick, travel halfway across the country to work in housekeeping. It's just not going to happen. But the government made very widespread changes. It was the only way that they could control a program of this magnitude, is to make sweeping changes across the board. So they basically outlined that, you know what, this is no longer going to be an option for Canadian employers. They made significant limitations, which basically made it an impossible program to utilize. And all of our clients started getting very, very upset. We started getting a lot of phone calls from really the hundreds of employers we were representing nationwide.
And this is mostly hospitality now.
Hospitality, tourism, landscaping, restaurant industry, Rocky Mountain resorts, you know, a little bit of everything.
And just to make the distinction, we were talking about this before, I think many people have the conception of the temporary foreign worker in the agricultural sector. And we see Mexicans coming to pick fruit in Ontario. So are these one and the same, or are these two different programs?
So those are very, very different programs. The temporary foreign worker program is extremely separate from the seasonal agricultural worker program. They're governed by two completely different elements, although they all funnel into the same umbrella at the end of the day. There's also a totally separate division called the Live-In Caregiver Program, which shares some commonalities, but is not necessarily affected significantly by the really cancellation of the program.
Right, good. So thanks for that clarification, because I wasn't sure about that, and that makes sense. So now for that part of the program, all these employers are screaming for labor because they don't have all of these temporary foreign workers anymore. So what's the response?
So funny enough, my girlfriend took me away for a week because I was in panic mode, and we were very stressed out, and we had all of these candidates that we wanted to deliver on, and we had all of these employers that desperately needed staff, and we didn't have that solution. So while we were away, we started brainstorming, and we came up with, you know, common elements of some of the work I've done in my past, plus some very interesting components of what it would take to be excited for Canadians to take these jobs. So we went to government and we said, what was the primary reason for this change? And they said, we've got record high levels of youth unemployment in certain areas across Canada. So we went to our employers and we said, well, what would it take to create a program that would be exciting for these individuals? And we held some focus groups with that area. And then we started bringing these Canadian youth together, these millennials, these 18 to 30-year-old people who are one in two in some cities in Canada still living with their parents, in their parents' basements, unemployed, unable to work, and are just dying for the opportunity to get out. They want to work, but they haven't found their place yet. So we held focus groups with these candidates, and we said, what would it take to convince you to move halfway across the country, to move to some really beautiful locations and take some great jobs? And we found some really incredible information, some details that really blew me away. This is not a group that wants to take a year off and just dart around Europe. This is not a group that wants to work a summer job and not have any form of career development at the end. This is a group that is interested in making significant commitments to their future, but are not interested in finding their permanent job. They're not interested in finding their forever job.
Right. So they're okay to take a stepping stone job, but they want it to lead to something, and they want it to be substantial and get references and get good things on their resume and move
Absolutely.
Forward.
You're completely right. So we put all of that information together, and we created something I'm extremely excited about, something that I'm having so much fun with, which is called Mobilized Jobs. And what Mobilized Jobs does is it matches individuals generally between the ages of 18 and 30, just because that's the age range we find the most success with. It's not an absolute hard rule. So if you're 31, I do have a few people who are early 30s who are young at heart that are interested in a program like this. And we match individuals into groups of four. And every 4 months, we move those candidates to a new city to work in a completely different business, doing a completely different job. So over the course of the year, you have the opportunity to gain three valuable new on-site references, three hopefully permanent job offers at the end, and the opportunity to explore, to see Canada, to travel, to have the time of your life, and to really have the best year possible. Most of our placements are in the Rockies. They're in regions of Western Canada that are very, very popular. You know, we've got lots of placements in Banff. We've got lots of placements in the tourism sector. And the candidates we've got so far are just having a really great time.
I know. We're going to try and get one of the candidates on the line here in a few minutes. But so just in terms of the actual work that people are doing, you know, there's all kinds of different jobs that you've described here. You know, it's in the hospitality industry. How are people responding to the opportunities, given that it's a structured program, and I think that's one of the things that they're liking, mm-hmm. but given some of the jobs, what are the sort of things that people are weighing, what I like about it, what I don't like about it, in terms of the prospect of joining Mobilize Jobs?
Well, the hospitality industry definitely attracts a certain type of person. You know, these are for people who like the customer service industry. These are for people who like serving people. These are for people who like front desk or back of house or kitchen or serving positions. But what we're finding is we recruit people who can persevere. That's one of the most important elements of our recruitment sources. We don't have really aggressive criteria when it comes time to screening. We want people who have had some form of a high school education. We want people who have a clear police record because they will be living with another individual. But for the most part, we screen on attitude. And the most important component to remember is that these placements are 4 months in length. Even if you get to a location and you're homesick and maybe you don't absolutely love what you're doing, it's 4 months and then you get to go on your next adventure. So we're finding that a lot of people are embracing this. You know, the training is pretty extensive when they get from place to place, but it's a pretty phenomenal experience for all of these individuals on the ground.
And you said it's in groups of four. So mm-hmm. instead of just, you know, me going and doing this one job for 4 months and moving to the next, what is the kind of group program? And you know, what else am I learning besides learning the job, whatever mm-hmm. the job is, what else am I learning in terms of my own career development and interacting with other people?
Well, not only career skills that you'll be taking home at the end of the day, but you're also going to be learning some pretty important life skills. We're going to learn how to budget. We're going to learn how to live with others. You're going to learn how to grocery shop for yourself if you've never lived outside of your home. You're going to be gaining all kinds of valuable on-the-job experience, but you're also going to be living with that same group of four friends who will become family by the end of the year. And every 4 months, you're going to be traveling together, you're going to be exploring together, you're going to be experience Canada together. So it's a pretty incredible experience.
And at the end of it, so they've had these three mm-hmm. kind of work terms almost, mm-hmm. and they've, you know, built those relationships. They've gotten those references. Hopefully they did a good job. Mm-hmm. What's then the transition afterwards, right? We got a good mm-hmm. year's worth of program. Mm-hmm. They're employed. And now we're back to the question of how do we keep youth from being underemployed or unemployed?
So there's a lot of options available. My employers right now are screaming for staff. And if I could offer them permanent staff, they would be thrilled. But that's not a requirement for this component. There's lots of permanent opportunities. They can come home if they'd like, or they can stay on with Mobilize and help us grow this team and work in a supervisory capacity running their own pod. Or they can go back and work with any one of their favorite employers and stay there permanently and work throughout their chains.
I think we actually have one of your participants on the line here. Alicia Clark is in Valemont, BC. Alicia, do we have you on the line?
You do.
Hey, welcome to Career Buzz. I'm here with Benjamin Guth, and we're talking about this Mobilize Jobs program. Alicia, can you paint us a picture? Where are you and what are you doing?
Right now, I'm in Valemont, BC. I came from St. John's, Newfoundland, and I'm a front desk agent at a Best Western hotel here, living the dream.
Nice. So how was it for you to join Mobilize Jobs? Where did you start from? Where were you in Canada before you got into the program?
So I'm actually from St. John's, Newfoundland, and this is my first placement. I came here about 3 weeks ago.
And are you having fun?
I am. I'm having a time here. I've done more in this 3 weeks than I have in the past year of my life. I've went hiking. I've went 4x4ing in the mountains. We have like campfires every single night with my pod, and it's just amazing. Like you can watch the northern lights dance over the mountains, and there's millions of stars here. Like the view is amazing.
That sounds great. Let's get out of downtown Toronto and go there. So, Alicia, what was it like? How did you find Mobilize Jobs? And then, you know, talking to your peers back in St. John's, you know, what was the reaction with you and your friends when you found out about the program?
Well, when I started talking about it, everyone thought I was crazy. They were like, "What are you doing? Like, you're just going to up and leave and go." And I was like, "You know what? I'm down. I just want to explore Canada." And it seemed like a great opportunity. Like, it's just, yeah.
So, Alicia, did you find us on the internet?
I actually heard about it from Canada AM. I was at work one day, and I was watching the news, and I seen Ben on the news, and he was talking about Mobilize, and I was like, wow, that just sounds amazing. What a great opportunity. And I applied, not thinking much of it, like coming from Newfoundland. And then they answered me right away, and they gave me the opportunity to come out here, and I just took it. And it's been an amazing experience so far.
Alicia, what were you doing? You just said that you were you heard Canada AM while you were at work. What was your situation? Did you go to post-secondary? You know, what was your job before you got into the program?
Well, I'm 19 years old. Back home, I was just out of high school. I was working home care back home. And, yeah, we were getting ready to go out one day, and we were watching the news, and I heard about this program, and I was just like, wow, this seems like such a great opportunity, for sure.
So you had to tell your employer at the time that you're going to take off and go out to BC. How did that go?
Well, like I said, everybody, even my employer, he was just like, are you sure this is what you want to do? Like, everybody thought it was just, you know, so fast. Like, it was just a spur of the moment kind of thing, but I'm so glad I took this opportunity.
And how is it with the pod, right? It sounds like you're in a group of four of you. How has that kind of connection and relationship been building amongst the four of you?
So before I came here, I actually had no idea who I was going to meet, who I was going to be living with, what I was going to be doing. So it was kind of one big question mark. And when I showed up, like, I was so scared at first, but it was amazing. Like, they're like family now. Like, we're all so close. We do everything together. I love my job here. We're just, like, experiencing this all together. It's such a great time. Like,
so, Alicia, I actually just got an email from your boss yesterday telling me not only how much she absolutely loves you guys, but that she actually needs more mobilizers to come out. So if there are any listeners out there that are interested in traveling ASAP, we have jobs right now that you can actually go and join Alicia.
Oh, yeah, you wouldn't regret it, for sure. It's such an amazing time.
We've got all the techs here in the studio actually putting their thumbs up. They're all joining, too. Alicia, what do you think is going to happen next? I know you're just in the first of the three rotations. Do you know what the next two will be, and do you have a sense? I know it's just at the beginning, but do you have a sense of what might happen at the end of the program?
Right now I'm just going with it and seeing how it goes. This first location is just mind-blowing, so I'm like, I definitely can't wait to find out my next location. We don't find out till a month before we actually go, so I'm excited to find out where I will be going next. You do a mountain location, a rural location, and a metropolitan location, so I'm excited to find out where I'm going to be going and to experience it with all these new people and meeting new people and trying new things. Oh my gosh. Amazing.
That says it all, Alicia. Thanks so much for joining us here on Career Buzz. Really appreciate it. And have a great time with your Mobilize experience out in BC.
Thank you for having me.
That was Alicia Clark. She's a member or a participant, I guess, in the program Mobilize Jobs. My guest today is Benjamin Guth. He's actually the founder of Mobilize Jobs and also VP of a recruitment company called Diamond Global. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on Career Buzz on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto, worldwide at CIUT.FM. Ben, we'll continue the conversation a little bit after break. We're just at 11:30, so I want to break for music and station ID. I know you brought a song that you wanted to play. What did you bring and why?
So I actually put the decision of which song to play out to all of the mobilizers in the field, and so I would like to dedicate this to all of my guys on the ground right now. This is Troopers, We're Here for a Good Time.
The experienced man knows what to expect at Harry Rosen. But what if you're just starting out in the world? Well, you should know we carry the likes of Burberry, Moncler, Canada Goose, New Balance, Seven Jeans, and Giuseppe Zanotti, and that a Harry Rosen clothing advisor really can assist you.
Right here, right now. Every day, CIUT 89.5, the sound of your city. Toronto.
And we're back at Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin. Before moving on with our interview from this morning, I want to let listeners know about the inspiring podcasts of Career Buzz episodes. If you click the Career Buzz button at careercycles.com, you'll get the archive. We've got, I don't know, 200 or 300 amazing interviews. Last show on May 13th, we had Dr. Marcia Sirota. And she's a psychiatrist, and she started an institute called the Ruthless Compassion Institute, talking about how to be kind, both to others and yourself, not nice, not to be a people pleaser, what happens at work when you're a people pleaser versus doing what you really want. And she's talking about being kind and not nice. It was a fascinating conversation. That's Marcia Sirota on the May 13th episode of Career Buzz. Click Career Buzz at careercycles.com and tune in. We're back with Ben Guth. He's in front of an organization called Mobilize Jobs, and we just heard from one of his participants, Alicia Clark. She's out in BC, originally from St. John's, Newfoundland. So, Ben, we're hearing about this program. It sounds like it's the beginning days of the program, and you have approximately 70 mm-hmm. participants so far. Just contrast for me what it looks like now in 2015 compared to what it might have looked like a couple of years ago when the temporary foreign worker program was in existence. How many people were we bringing in to take these jobs? And now, how is it working to replace that?
So the temporary foreign worker program was really a cornerstone of the staffing industry in Canada, specifically in the rural tourism sectors. Regions like Fort McMurray and Banff and Valemont, all of these are areas that would have utilized the program previously. In many cases, greater than 50% of their hotel staff were international employees.
How many would have that been? You know, just is there a number that you can put on it?
In certain hotels, we had recruited over 100 candidates just to fill those positions in
just
some of
in
the
one
larger
hotel.
Properties.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about thousands and thousands of people. And what countries were they coming from?
So before the changes to the program, Diamond alone had two offices in the Philippines. We had offices in North Africa. We had offices in Barbados and Mexico, working in Hong Kong as well. So it was a very wide range, but I would say the primary recruitment source for the majority of the Canadian tourism sector was either India or the Philippines.
Hmm. And now with those numbers dropping, like dropping completely mm-hmm. or small numbers, how is Mobilize Jobs coming to replace it with all, you know, it's just a small number right now.
So as you can imagine, demand for the program is quite high. We've got a lot of employers who are very interested in this type of option. Canadian employers are very excited to invest in Canadian staff. They've just never had the tool, the program that can bridge that gap. So Mobilize is still new. We launched our first group of 20 candidates in January. We brought an additional 50 candidates into the program in May. And we're looking to get up to 500 new candidates a year very, very quickly. But we won't hit those targets unless you know the program's going absolutely phenomenally, and we have the right people on board.
Who else is stepping into the void?
As of right now, that's a great question. Some of the local provincial associations are developing changes to their provincial immigration programs to allow for candidates to come through from overseas. But for the most part, the area is relatively empty right now. You know, we're just working on stepping in and fixing this issue.
So it sounds like what's next for you personally is really expanding this program a lot.
So our goal is to get to 500 new candidates a year. Within the next 5 years, I'd like to take this to the United States, and within the next 7 to bring this program to Europe.
Sounds exciting. Mm-hmm. So, Benjamin, I'm thinking about my next guest here. Benjamin, back to your personal story. There's some twists and turns in it. You didn't even think that you were going to join the recruitment business, and there you were, and now you're still in it. Given what you've experienced and now thinking about listeners kind of trying to figure out their own career paths, what advice can you give based on your experience about how to make good choices, both career and life choices? You were in Halifax. You came back to Toronto. There's a life component, and there's a career development component. Mm-hmm. What can you share with listeners about that?
The greatest experiences that I've had in my career and my personal life have come out of the greatest disasters I've had in my career and personal life. So identify when you're at rock bottom, identify when everything feels like it's against you, and look for the opportunity there, because I would not be where I am. Mobilize would not be where we are without the strongest possible team of incredible employees by my side and team members by my side, and the opportunity that exists out of disaster.
Right on. Great message. Mm-hmm. If people want to find out more about you and Mobilize Jobs, Benjamin, how do they do that?
MobilizeJobs.ca is a great source, or Facebook.com/MobilizeJobs has lots of stories and testimonials from people who are actually on the program now. That's a great resource.
Great. Benjamin Guth, thank you so much for joining us here on Career Buzz.
Thank you, Mark.
So we're on to our next interview. We have Jonathan Fishbane on the line. He got a master's degree in systems design engineering and was contemplating whether he was going to go do a PhD and have an academic career, or was he going to cut loose from academe and get his hands dirty while trying to make the world a better place. Jonathan Fishbane chose the latter, joined Engineers Without Borders for a couple of years before founding a successful startup called Ethical Ocean that he just sold a couple of years ago. Now Jonathan is all about building cool things and disrupting entrenched systems. Jonathan Fishbane joins me live by phone. Jonathan, welcome to Career Buzz.
Hi, nice to talk to you, Mark.
So what are you doing these days in your career post-selling your company, Jonathan?
Well, it's funny. When we sold Ethical Ocean, I needed some downtime. And my plan was to actually, you know, take a few months off, sort of recalibrate, kind of enjoy downtime. I haven't had downtime in a really long time. And as it turns out, some cool opportunities kept flying my way. So I ended up doing a little bit of consulting and a really cool opportunity to work with an emerging education startup came out of Toronto. And I just couldn't pass it up. So right now I'm working for another startup out of Toronto doing education technology software.
Right. And what are you doing with them?
I'm mostly an engineer. It's interesting. I love working with startups. I love that startups kind of work in this sort of empty space. You know, there's nothing there, and then the startup comes and then tries to build something to fill that space. And it's the same actually with companies. When companies start, it's usually an idea, but there's not a route around that idea. So as an engineer, I can contribute to the idea, and that's what I'm doing for the company. But I'm also helping to sort of build those engineering processes, sort of how you get more mature, how you build the product, how you work with people to build the product internally. And I really like that stuff too.
What is the name of the company, and what stage are they at?
The company is called Core4. The product is called Edsby. It's just past a seed stage right now. So it has some funding. We have a lot of clients right now. And we're actually looking to kind of accelerate our growth. So, you know, the next 2 years, 1 year, 2 years are going to be really exciting for us.
Great. Well, what skills and strengths are you drawing on, both in this Edsby position, which is a bit different than it was at Ethical Ocean? What are the skills and strengths that you draw on to be successful?
That's a great question. I mean, there's obviously my engineering skills. But I've always been, kind of throughout my career, I've always been interested in both kind of people and processes. So I've sort of learned and just been curious about how people work together, and how can people work together better. So just through all of my experiences, these have always kind of, you know, sparked my interest. So right now, I'm actually drawing heavily upon that. Looking at, you know, with a startup, you will kind of have a loose team together. Everybody's really focused on their own activities. But you always have to kind of bring it together and get, you know, keep sight of the bigger picture. So that's, you know, that's something that I've learned throughout my career that I really am drawing on quite heavily right now.
Great. Now, stepping back in time, Jonathan, you studied engineering. I think it was software engineering.
That's right.
What led to making that choice in the first place?
That's a really funny story. When I was in basically in grade 12, the beginning of grade 12, because I was part of the 4-year curriculum in Ontario, I decided that I wanted to be a doctor because I really liked science and I really liked biology, so I was going to be a doctor. And then midway through, I sort of started thinking, I started having doubts. I was always good at computers. I was always really enjoyed programming. I kind of did it as a hobby. And really liked computers, so I decided that maybe I should go into computer engineering. I had a lot of kind of people I looked up to in my life who were engineers, who were sort of, you know, saying that I should think about that direction. So about midway through my grade 12 year, I decided that, you know what, I'm going to switch and I'm going to apply to engineering schools. And it was a little bit of a switch for me, especially because I had to sort of pick up some new credits, which I ended up having to do in sort of half a year of a grade 13 year. Then when I looked at schools, I decided like, well, I didn't know, you know, computer engineering. I thought computer engineering was what I wanted to do. So I applied to a bunch of computer engineering schools. I applied to Waterloo. I applied to U of T. I applied to Queen's. I think I applied to University of Guelph. And I really didn't think I was going to get into Waterloo. So when they sent me the supplementary application, I was so focused on computer engineering and I was so sure I wasn't going to get into the Waterloo that for my secondary choice, I put down software engineering. And I did it as a little bit of a joke because the software engineering entrance requirements were even higher than computer engineering. And I'm like, well, if you don't let me into computer engineering, there's no way you're going to let me into software engineering. So that's my little, you know, secret joke that I was going to play on the school. And as it turns out, they deferred my acceptance from my first choice to computer engineering to software engineering, and they called my bluff. So at the time, it was a brand new program. No one had ever taken it before. And I very quickly had to learn a lot about it because I was now faced with the real choice of, do I want to go into this program, which did not seem like a real choice before. So I had a call with the director and the associate director of the program, and they were sort of explaining to me what software engineering really was, and it was a lot different than what I thought about it, what I thought it was, and it was actually very similar to what I thought computer engineering was. So they convinced me, and the way they convinced me was that they told me, like, software engineering is about, you know, building products with software, very much on the product focus side, which is different than the computer science side, which is more around the theory, and different than the computer engineering side, which is also very focused on the hardware. And that really spoke to me, so I decided to go and, you know, take the leap and go into that first year of that program, and to be honest, I have no regrets about doing it.
It's a great story, Jonathan, especially, you know, medicine, your original target. I mean, that's such a high bar to jump over for people. Many people want to get in, and it's hard to do, and you had your sight set for it, and to have such an abrupt change in at the last minute and then really love what you changed into, I think, is a testament to the way people need to really tune in to what's true for them as they make these important choices and decisions. As you look back on that moment, you know, the fork in the road with engineering on one side and medicine on the other, what's your perspective on that fork in the road back there?
It was interesting. I mean, when I went back and had to really be faced with the decision, I mean, when you think these things through within when it's not decision time, you sort of build up these, you know, you build it up in your mind to be what you think it's going to be and how you think it's going to go. But when you're actually faced with a practical decision, it gets a lot more real and it gets very different. So when I was faced with a practical decision, it kind of, my eyes were a little more open. And I started looking at medicine, and I really liked helping people. And I worked as a lifeguard, so I kind of really liked, you know, helping people who were, you know, in distress and in need. And I thought that really spoke to me. But to be honest, biology was good and I was good at it, but I wasn't passionate about it. You know, I didn't have dreams of cells or, you know, dreams of better ways to treat people. I just wanted to help people. And I think one thing I realized is that I didn't need to be a doctor to help people. I actually thought that there was a lot of opportunity within engineering and especially within software engineering at the time to be able to help people. And that kind of empty space, and maybe that's a theme throughout my career, that trying to fill empty space, that kind of made me a lot more excited than kind of taking what I thought was more of the safe path and trying to get into medical school.
Right on. Interesting. My guest this morning is Jonathan Fishbane. He is the builder of cool things and disruptor of entrenched systems, now with a product called Edsby, formerly with Ethical Ocean. And I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on Career Buzz on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and worldwide at CIUT.fm. So, Jonathan, at the end of the software engineering degree, you know, lots of people have another choice to make. You could go out and work. You could do a graduate degree. You could think about an academic career. What was your mindset at the end of that degree?
Well, I was pretty stressed because I didn't know what I wanted to do. To a certain extent, I still don't know what I want to do, but I've gotten less stressed about that. But at the time, it was my first... I remember thinking back in my before starting my last term at the university that this, outside of choosing a university, this is the next big decision that I need to make. And it's probably one of the biggest decisions I've ever had to make. You know, what do I do with my life now? And I had options. And I had a lot of different people giving me advice and a lot of different people giving me conflicting advice. You know, I had a lot of professors who were telling me that, you know, I was really good at school, so I should consider academia. And I did kind of like the research. I did a little bit of undergraduate student research at Waterloo, and it seemed kind of interesting to me, but I knew I only kind of dabbled on the surface. And then I had a lot of people who, you know, a lot of my friends were going out and getting great jobs. And, you know, at the time, the software market was just starting to rebound, and a whole lot of people were hiring in a whole lot of cool companies were just starting to form, like Google was, you know, just starting to do some really massive hiring. Microsoft was still a big employer, and they were all interested in me. And it was a really tough choice. What I ended up doing, though, is I ended up deciding that I'm going to do a master's degree. And I had some professors who were saying, well, you should go right to a PhD. And, you know, I kind of wanted to take the safe bet. I was really interested. I had a really cool opportunity to work with a professor on a really interesting project that spoke to me around machine learning and understanding language. And to be honest, that just kind of was like, well, this is only 2 years. This is 2 years, and I get to try out academia. I get to try out and see if this is for me. And if I really, really like it, then I can pursue a PhD. And, you know, then all the more reason to try. And
sounds,
if I really, really
sounds
don't
logical.
Like it, and yeah, just if to... I don't like it, though, then I know I don't like it. And then I can say, I'm going to do something else.
Yeah, and just to clarify the two paths there, you know, you did a Master of Applied Science. That's the more theoretical route that would have led to the PhD should you have chosen it. Then we have other more practical and applied degrees, more like a Master of Engineering. So when you were making that choice, was it obvious to you to do the more theoretical one to keep the door open to the possible PhD?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly why I wanted to do it. I wanted to keep that door open. I wanted to see if that was a pathway. The more applied part didn't really speak to me personally. I know it speaks to a lot of people, but for me, it was more of trying the theoretical, the research side. Because to be honest, that's what I was more interested in, and what I thought I was more interested in from my undergraduate time.
Right on. So moving forward to the next turning point, right? You've done the degree, and now there's I guess another turning point. And you know, there's all this conflicting advice, which is so interesting to hear you talk about. And professors are probably saying, "Oh, you're smart, Jonathan. You should do a PhD and be a professor." And other people are saying other things. So what happened there at the end of that graduate degree?
Well, what I realized is I was successful. I was actually quite successful in my graduate research. I was publishing as a master's student, which I was later told is you know, a pretty high bar. But I was really bored. I don't know if it was bored because I found it easy, or I didn't know if it was bored because I just wasn't really all that interested in it. But when I summed it up to somebody in the later stage of my degree, when I sort of tried to express kind of my frustration with it, my master's, was that I was taking a research area that very few people knew about very deeply and basically, you know, moving it a couple centimeters forward. You know, yes, it was new stuff, and yes, it was interesting work that no one had done before, but really no one really knew about it. And in the grand scheme of things, is it really the contribution that I wanted to make in my life? And at the end of my degree, I sort of decided, well, no, I mean, I'm not driven enough to be able to pursue this for the rest of my life to really find it meaningful and interesting.
So interesting. You know, the two clues that I've heard you say, and I think people need to be paying attention to these clues. One was a sort of internal clue that you were bored, and that's an important thing to notice. And then this other clue about the meaningfulness of your work, and is this a contribution I want to make? And it sounds like those two clues combined led you to make the choice. So what actually happened? What choice did you make? What happened next?
Well, at the time I was involved in... Since I was bored and I actively sort of searched for other things to, you know, to occupy my time and occupy my interest. And I got involved with Engineers Without Borders at the very start of my grad degree. And I really enjoyed my time there, and I made a lot of contacts in the organization, and I was, you know, taking on a lot of projects in the organization for them back in Canada. And an opportunity came up to take a job with them. To take a job in their national office leading a brand new program, a program that was sort of trialed at a couple of universities around engineering education and trying to change and try to add more relevancy into the real world for engineering education, especially into sort of social causes. And that was really interesting to me, you know, to be the first person to sort of take on this program and try to nationalize it and try to build a structured program around it with the resources that Engineers Without Borders had.
Right on. Did you start out as a volunteer gig, or was it a paid gig right away, or did it transform?
I was working as a volunteer. I had started working as a volunteer on this project about a year earlier, helping to run a meeting of deans of engineering from across the country at the Engineers Without Borders National Conference. And that, you know, took a lot of my time, but it sort of got me exposed to that project. But yes, at that point, I was working as a volunteer.
It's great. We had another guest recently on Career Buzz, Mike Clausen, who also worked at Engineers Without Borders. And so interesting to hear how these volunteer gigs, yours and his, very quickly turned into paid jobs, and not just paid jobs, but really good paid jobs that gave you amazing experience moving forward. That was really instrumental for career development.
And I think an interesting thing about that is I know Mike, and I remember when Mike joined Engineers Without Borders, and I don't think any of us at the time thought that that would happen. It was just through finding things that were interesting to us and finding the opportunities to really pursue it that allowed that to kind of blossom into a career step.
Right on. Well, now listeners of Career Buzz know that if you volunteer, it sometimes turns out that you get a paid gig out of it. Not to expect it, but that it sometimes happens. So Jonathan, I mean, it's been so interesting, and we just have a few more minutes of the story, and I know there's a few more twists and turns. Briefly, can you tell us what happened? The Ethical Ocean chapter of your life sounds so interesting. What happened to begin it and end it in a nutshell?
Well, Ethical Ocean sort of stemmed out of my involvement in Engineers Without Borders, that a lot of people that I was working with, you know, a lot of friends that I made within the organization, we started looking at especially things around the fair trade movement. The fair trade movement was so big at the time in the UK and in Europe, and no one was really talking about it in North America. And the broader thing around the fair trade movement is this thing of ethical consumerism. You know, it's trying to ask questions about where your goods that you're buying are coming from, and to try to see if you can exert some of your values through your purchasing choices. And we looked at around in the North American market, and we found that there was really no one doing this. No one was really talking about, you know, buying goods that represent your personal values or any kind of personal change that you want to see in the world. So we figured, well, you know, I'm an engineer. I was working with another business, a guy with a business background, or another guy with a law background. But, well, we seem like a very capable team. Let's see if we can build a product around this. Let's see if we can kind of bring this service into the North American market. And we started sort of dabbling in it. We built a store, we built some technology around it, and we started to get some sellers, people who wanted to sell their products on our site, and we started to get some customers. And eventually that started to grow to the point where, wow, we have something here. You know, maybe we should consider doing this as a full-time job. So at the time, we went out to go look for some funding to see if anybody wanted to support us. We appeared on Dragon's Den, and we actually got a deal from that. We were surprised that, you know.
Who did you make the deal with?
With Arlene Dickinson.
Oh, you did?
Dragon at the time.
We had Arlene Dickinson as a guest on the show and spoke to two other people who got chosen by her. So how did that work out for you?
Well, it worked out great. Just through talking to her, we were able to basically close a seed funding round for the company, which then allowed us, my co-founders and a couple of people that we actually hired, to quit their job and to work on EthicalOcean full time. And we eventually, you know, grew the company to the point where it was an acquisition target for another company, and that's eventually why we sold it.
Wow. So what happened? Who bought it and for how much?
It was bought, well, I can't discuss the details of the deal, but it was bought by a company called Motivanti, which was another ethical fashion startup out of Brooklyn, New York. And they were looking to both kind of accelerate their growth and also accelerate their growth in the Canadian market, because at the time they didn't have any operations in Canada, and we were cross-border, so we seemed like a good fit for them.
So interesting. So how do you follow such a success? It sounds like it was a success. We don't know the numbers. You haven't retired yet, so maybe it wasn't that much money.
I don't think I'll ever retire, at least at this point in my career. But it was decent that we could call it a success. But to be honest, once it was done, I wanted to take a little bit of a break, which I sort of did. It didn't really happen as much of a break as I wanted. But I decided that I really liked, you know, working with startups, especially startups that I felt had really cool products and products that can really kind of change the context around it. You know, not just a product that people are going to use, but a product that's actually going to change how people use it and how they do other things within the space that the product's in.
Right on.
That's what led me to Edgy.
Jonathan, we have like 30 seconds just to wrap up. It's been so interesting to hear your story. Is there any one, you know, in a word or two, as people are listening to your story and hearing the twists and turns, in a word or two, any kind of advice that you can share based on your own experience?
Yeah, I think my advice would be don't be scared, and don't be scared to make a mistake. Decisions can always be changed. Paths can always be corrected. But try to do the thing that really speaks to you. Don't worry what other people are saying. Don't worry about making mistakes. Try to make the decision that really speaks to you at the point where you are in your life. And if it ends up being wrong, then you can fix it.
Right on. Jonathan Fishbane, thank you so much for joining us here on Career Buzz. It's been inspiring.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Bye for now. That was Jonathan Fishbane. He's working at a company called Edsby, edsby.com. You've been listening to Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations. Here on CIUT 89.5 FM, I'm your host, Mark Franklin. More about me at careercycles.com. Please email me if you have comments or questions. It's mark@careercycles.com. Thanks to my guests today, Jonathan Fishbane, Benjamin Guth, Alicia Clark. Technical production today was by Kate Latimer, Yao Ming, Lian, and Sean Mitchell. An MP3 of today's show will be available from the Career Buzz button at careercycles.com. Catch Career Buzz every Wednesday.